listening to podcast 3 of Share Care Scotland's podcast sessions. These sessions aim to provide different insights into how short breaks and respite care are planned and delivered. And of course, with COVID and its impact on carers, on service users, and on providers, we're particularly interested in using these podcasts just to hear about how people and organisations have faced and hopefully overcome some of the challenges that have been thrown up by the pandemic. So it's July, and I'm here in a very sunny Fife, along with my colleague, Kate Hogarth. Kate, do you want to say hello?
Hello.
There you go. For this episode, I'm delighted to say that we're crossing the pond on this occasion to the United States, and we're linking up with Joe Kagan, who's the Programme Director of the ARCH National Respite Network and Resource Centre. Jill, thanks so much for joining us. It's just after 3 p.m. here. What time is it with you in America, and where are you speaking to us from?
It's just a little bit after 10 a.m. in the morning, and I'm just outside of Washington, D.C.
Well, listen, it is great to have this time to chat with you. We've spoken a number of times in the past, but I've never really had the opportunity to talk to you in more depth about ARCH and your work, and also dig a little bit deeper into respite policy and practice in the States and how this compares to Scotland. Although I think it is important to say, although it's maybe stating the obvious, that we have a population of just over 5.4 million here in Scotland, and you have a population of what, 340 million or something like that?
That's not
in
right. The state.
Yeah, so we're talking different scale here, aren't we? But nonetheless, it'll be really interesting just to find out a little bit more about how our policy and practice compares. But before we get into that, I just thought it might be nice just to set the scene, if you could describe a little about the work of ARCH, how the organisation came about. Actually, I think came about roughly about the same time as my own organisation, our own organisation, Share Care Scotland. And also, if you could fit into that introduction, Jill, a little bit about your own career journey that brought you to your current position as the National Programme Director.
Well, thank you so much, Don. I want to also say that I'm really delighted and excited to be here with you and Kate. I'm actually a great admirer of your work and follow it very closely through your newsletters and your website. And I'm always looking at your incredibly wonderful products and creative ideas. So I'm just as excited. I hope at some point we can do a mutual podcast. And I'll get to interview you as well and learn about what you're doing, more about what you're doing in Scotland, and be able to share it with our network. ARCH has actually been around since 1990. So we have a fairly long history, though it's gone through quite an evolution over the years. It started out as a training and technical assistance project funded by the Children's Bureau. In the federal government. So it was very child focused in the early days. And I came to it through the policy avenue because I was working for Congress at the time for a committee called the House Select Committee on Children, Youth and Families. And I worked for a wonderful congressman from California who was a champion of people with disabilities and their families. And respite was a huge issue for him. And when we went around the country collecting information about children and families, respite, when we were talking to families of kids with disabilities, respite always rose to the top. And so we started off way back in the mid-1980s drafting legislation to support respite care. And that developed into ARCH, and ARCH through the 1990s, really built a wonderful grassroots network, building state respite coalitions in more than half of the states. And we really took the lead from our grassroots network about where to go next. And there were some states, especially out west in Oregon and Wisconsin, Nebraska, that had taken the lead on something called lifespan respite, where they really felt they could increase their advocacy voice and their power by advocating for everyone across the lifespan, not just children. And they developed state-run lifespan respite programs, which were meant to build more coordinated systems so that families could have a much easier time accessing services and funding sources to pay for respite. And we followed their lead. And from my perspective, until 2009, I really was primarily focused on the policy side, advocating for respite services at the federal level and trying to replicate what those several states had done out west. They really became the best practices for what we moved toward with our federal legislation in 2000. We introduced the bill, I think it was around 2002. We built a national coalition of organizations. And I have to say, I was very skeptical at first, and I told our network, You will never get people in Washington, D.C. to cross the aging adult disability population and the child population. Everyone is very territorial. No one will want to come together. It's not going to work at the federal level. And much to my surprise, we held our first summit in 2000 or 2001. And we invited aging organizations, disability and chronic disease organizations, children's organizations, and everybody came. And everybody said, this is an issue for our constituency, regardless of their age or condition. And we're not doing enough to provide respite support, and we want to work with you. And that was an amazing realization to me. And so it became a pretty powerful lobby for moving a bill that addressed respite care across the lifespan. And we've been doing that ever since.
It's really interesting, the lifespan element to it, Jill, because I think, you know, here in Scotland, we still have very much, you know, children and young people services and then adult services. And within those sort of two areas, you get provision that provides respite support, but that people, families always talk about the cliff edge. You know, yeah. As their children are growing up and then they then transition to adult services, everything stops and they start having to, you know, negotiate with a completely different department or set of people. Right. And you don't get that continuity of support or care. Is that...
Well, I'm not saying our program has solved the problem by any stretch of the imagination, but we have a good start in many states.
And do you think the lifespan legislation that you referred to, it took a few years to get from this sort of the idea that this is something we need to take forward to the point at which it's actually, you know, approved or signed off. Has that had the effect that you expected? Has it, or what effect has that had, is maybe the better question.
It did take us quite a while to get the legislation passed. At the time we were working on it, the idea in Congress of any new programs of any kind, it wasn't that it was respite or the focus of the legislation. It was just any new program, any new funding was severely frowned upon. And so it took a very long time. And it was actually quite an accomplishment when Congress passed the law in 2006, because not much else was happening in Congress at all. So we saw that as a great accomplishment. But then it took us another 3 years to even get the funding for it, because the first legislation was just authorizing the program, and then we have to go through the funding process. Okay. And then even when we went through the funding process, it was significantly less money than the original law had called for. And we've really been struggling with that since 2009, when it was first funded. But we're starting to see, you know, in some ways the pandemic has really it's been a horrible situation for most families and for most of us, but it did shed an amazing light on the needs of family caregivers and the fact that they weren't being supported at all. And so now we have, right now we have a real resurgence, especially with our new administration, around focusing on making sure that we have more home and community-based services and supports for family caregivers.
Right. And if we look to before COVID, let's say, because the way that families would access respite care. We've talked about the legislation at the federal level, but I would imagine that a lot of the important stuff happens at the state level in terms of, you know, making a meaningful difference to carers or caregivers on the ground. Would it be right? And you have, what, 50 states, they're all autonomous, I suppose, and to a large extent, as far as their, you know, local arrangements and policy and legislation is concerned. Does that then mean that there is such a wide variation in the levels and availability of respite care in the different states? Does it very much depend on what the priorities are state by state?
Absolutely. The largest federal funding source for respite by far is something called the Medicaid Home and Community-Based Waiver Program. And Medicaid is focused on low-income populations. But that is the largest source of funding. And every state, because of, just by the term waiver, implies that every state can design its own program for Medicaid waivers. And so not only can they design their own program, but they can design multiple programs within their state, depending on the age of the population or the condition of the person being served. So a large state like Texas might have 8 or 10 different waivers. And the waiver program also differs significantly from the regular Medicaid program, which is probably comparable to your national health program, but only for low-income people.
Yeah.
But the waiver program is allowed to impose caps on people served. So there are long waiting lists in many states. And in recent years, states have been shifting from a fee-for-service type program to a managed care program. And those managed care programs are generally run by the private insurance industry. And so then there are additional restrictions that might be imposed around accessing care. In some instances, it might be better because they're able to serve more people under managed care. And for the most part, they've been trying to replicate the same services that were provided under Medicaid. But people are very fearful that a managed care system could lead to reductions in services too. But right now, you know, everything's proceeding pretty well on the Medicaid front. Our president has now recommended a $400 billion increase in Medicaid home and community-based services. So we feel like we're finally starting to see some little trickle of light at the end of the tunnel. But, you know, I'm saying $400 billion, that's a lot of money just for home and community-based services for people with disabilities and the aging. And the advocates are saying that probably isn't even enough, but we have to start there because we're so far behind that amount right now. But that definitely means that at the state level, every state is different. If a family moves from one state to another, I get these calls all the time. Well, I had all these great services in California, but now I'm in Arkansas and there's nothing. I don't understand why is that happening? So that probably will continue to be a big issue for a while until we can equilibrate the amount of money that states have for services.
Is there the prospect of achieving that, Jill, do you think?
We're very optimistic right now, but you know our politics. Well, you may not know our politics here, but it's pretty volatile, especially right now. So while I can say right now there's tremendous optimism and excitement, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
And it will be, unfortunately, a completely partisan issue.
That must make the work that you do at ARCH particularly challenging then, is it? Because you've got that sort of lobbying role, which you doing it on a state-by-state basis would be incredibly... I mean, we haven't actually talked about what resource you have yourselves at ARCH. I mean, what size of an organization are we looking at? What vast team of people do you have working for you? What departments do you have?
Oh my goodness. Yeah, I know. It's me basically. And again, because the Lifespan Respite Program is so small and we are funded out of the Lifespan Respite Program now, Our policy work is not funded out of our federal money. We have to raise private funds to do that work. So it's even smaller.
Yeah.
And we're limited in how much lobbying we can do because we're federally funded. So our policy work is very, very tiny right now. And it's basically me. I have a fiscal agent that helps maintain the budget. And then I have consultants who come in on specific projects. And we have some, you know, consistent consultants. So I feel like they're my team.
Yeah. You've got a great group of people there.
And they're really incredible.
Yeah.
But their time is very limited, unfortunately. But so they do amazing work.
Absolutely. So, I mean, given that challenge, Jill, where do you think your work is most effectively directed? What areas of work do you think that you can lever the most influence, given you're a one person band to some extent?
I think the fact that the Lifespan Respite Program awards funds to individual states to build their state lifespan system, we're kind of tackling it one state at a time. So we working very closely with those states that have funding and helping them build their systems and provide services has been really effective. Even with their small grants, the work that they've been able to do to build partnerships, to leverage state money, to leverage private funds has really been quite amazing. Though it is still a very, very small program, but again, I have hope for the future that the lifespan model will someday become the model that we can all strive for.
Yeah. I've been really impressed with the work that you do in pulling together evidence and the particular sort of push that you've made on research to underpin that evidence as well, I think has been really important. Is that a key area for the work that you do as well, as this sort of policy influencing?
Research, increasing more, trying to encourage more research in the respite arena. I apologize for that.
It's okay.
Research has become a major focus of ours only because, well, not only because, for several reasons. One is that funders, government and private funders, as you know, increasingly are asking for what they call evidence-based services. Sometimes they have restrictions. We will only fund evidence-based services. And while we have wonderful anecdotal evidence about the benefits of respite and some isolated studies that might be focused on, you know, the frail elderly population or a small group of children with autism, we don't really have any well-established studies that we can point to as an evidence base. So we're really focused on building that base. We also want to encourage research and evaluation among our community-based services so that they can engage in continuous quality improvement. You know, look at what they're providing to families. Is it working? Is it meaningful? Is it person and family centered? And then gathering that data and using it to improve the quality of services that they're providing. And so we work on one end to encourage researchers and funders to do more rigorous types of studies, but now we're also focusing on trying to identify what we call innovative and exemplary respite services, and then trying to connect them to researchers, universities, folks that might be interested in evaluating at the local program level the work that they're doing, so we can really document the benefits of those individual type models of services. So we've got the big overall picture of respite focus, and then really looking at the community-based services models and trying to get them to a point where they can be truly replicable and look to as best practice models.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a great approach. You know, is you're actually sort of gathering the evidence and supporting services to improve or to measure their impact as you go along. And I think the report that you published a few years back was a framework for a research agenda.
Yes.
I mean, I keep that pretty much on my desk permanently.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
which I return to frequently because I just think it is so full of information that is relevant and useful to what we're trying to achieve here, you know, in Scotland and in the UK as well. I think we're missing a lot of the academic backup that I think you're sort of keen to develop and have developed, you know, in the States.
You've done some amazing work too with your scoping reviews and moving in that direction. I mean, we've looked to what you're doing in Scotland too, in gathering the evidence for short breaks and for respite.
Really interesting to hear, Jill, that you seem eternally optimistic about the
it's a struggle.
And the aspirations that you've got as well for the work that you do. So what are the exciting developments in respite provision in the US as you see them at the moment?
I did talk about this new level of awareness, especially among policymakers, of the needs of family caregivers. I think COVID really brought that to light. Not in a good way, in a very scary way, but sometimes to get policymakers' attention, it really requires some drastic outcomes to gain their attention. One big study that happened here was conducted by the Centers for Disease Control of the impact on COVID, the impact on people's mental health around COVID, and family caregivers were listed among the groups at highest risk of poor mental health outcomes and higher suicide rates. And I think that really, that was one of many stories that emerged from COVID that helped shed light. And again, I think with this new administration coming in, from day one, he's been talking about caregiving as an infrastructure building issue. The way we talk about highways and roads, improving those, he has been talking about caregiving as an infrastructure issue and trying to get these additional funds included in an infrastructure building legislation. He hasn't had much luck on the other side of the aisle and with that argument, which is why they pulled out the caregiving and some of the other larger issues. Paid family leave, for example, is another great focus. I think that employers, because of COVID, also recognize the extent to which caregiving is affecting the people that work for them. And, you know, in this country, there are almost two-thirds of our caregivers are working full-time. So they have to come to grips with that. And that really intensified during COVID, when people were now working at home and had to deal with older parents they were caring or for their children. It really came to light how stressful their lives are. And so there's a huge push right now for paid. We do not have paid family and medical leave here in this country, except in, I think, 5 states now have paid leave, but that leaves 45 states with nothing. When you have a child or when you're caring for a person with a disability or an older adult, work issues are tremendous. So I think there's going to be definitely some movement in that area. The new focus on keeping people out of nursing homes and institutions, given the tragedies that occurred there during COVID. There's an even greater push now for keeping families and individuals at home and in their communities. So there has to be the funding, not only for the direct community-based services, but for the family caregivers who take care of them for a significant number of people. So again, COVID, as horrible as it has been for so many, I think has helped move the policy forward a little bit. And only time will tell if actions follow promises and words. But there's a tremendous interest. I'm very involved in especially the disability advocacy community, and they are pushing night and day for these new improvements. So we're really hopeful right now on the policy front. But ask me again in 6 months, I'll let you know.
I think we definitely will ask you again in 6 months. I'm fascinated to see how that translates into
action. We're all on pins and needles here and working like crazy to make sure the focus doesn't shift away from this important work.
Yeah. So in terms of the sort of federal level, impact of COVID has really raised that level of awareness.
Yes.
At a much more micro level, what impact do you see COVID having on respite provision across the areas that you work in?
Well, I think another positive thing that has really happened, especially with community-based respite services that were forced to close down initially, or the fear of families having to bring someone into the home during COVID, has really, our network especially, but all of the individuals across the country who are working with families and supporting family caregivers pivoted beautifully to redefining respite and redefining support for family caregivers, and have really came up with really creative ways. That's why I love your inspirational breaks work that you're doing now, because I think what we came to realize, and that this was true even before COVID, that most families don't access the formal public service system for respite. They seek respite in informal ways from their communities of natural support. And we really need to be more focused on how do we help families identify what those informal breaks are, and how do we help build those types of services. And so for our network, especially for a state that might have a lifespan respite grant, you know, they started, of course, as everybody did, supporting families virtually through support groups, doing regular phone check-ins to make sure that families had what they needed. And then they, even though they were respite providers, they were doing things like delivering groceries and pharmaceutical items and doing drive-by visits, you know, outside to make sure people's social isolation didn't intensify even further than it already was. To now we have programs like in Alabama, our Alabama program is using their respite dollars to help family caregivers pay for mental health counseling as they identify it as a need. And fortunately, our federal funders supported that. They said the dollars that you used before, perhaps to help families pay for respite care, you know, specifically for someone to provide care to your loved one, you can now use that money more broadly and more flexibly and really focus on what the family says they need and then help them access that. You know, money for tablets or internet access. You know, whatever it was, it's really opened up the door to what is respite and how can we provide it more flexibly and meaningfully. Of course, that also gets back to the research issue, because now we have even more things we need to look at. You know, are these alternative forms of respite, these flexible forms of respite, really giving family caregivers the break they need to reduce their stress levels and improve their health and well-being? I mean, my guess is that some things are going to be better than others, but these things are even harder to study. I mean, how do you study them in a systematic, rigorous way? So they do pose additional challenges, but I think it's really wonderful that we can think more flexibly and open-mindedly and in a more person and family-centered way about what respite really means. I have to admit that over the years, I've been pretty rigid in my definition of respite, only because we have such a small amount of money to spend on a specific service. And I didn't want, there are other ways to get some of those other types of supports, you know, through other funding sources. And so I was very protective of our dollars. But I think now we really have to think more broadly and creatively about what it means to get respite.
Yeah, and I think that point that you make about your funders' flexibility as well is something that we certainly heard from networks we work with, that they have appreciated, you know, that flexibility and ability to make decisions quickly and based on the circumstances. That's something that people are keen not to lose as we move beyond COVID. So as we now, we're now moving out of lockdown in the UK, and I think things are broadly similar in the US. What, yeah. As we learn as countries to live with COVID or alongside it, what do you see as the biggest concerns or threats in relation to respite provision?
I think by far the largest issue is that as we move back toward more community-based services or in-home respite services, that we do not have enough people to provide that care. We have and I think this is worldwide, a crisis in the direct service workforce, not just for respite, but for providing supports to people across the age and disability spectrum. It's huge, huge, huge. One other change that we saw during COVID that's extremely positive, a lot of our programs provide respite in a very self-directed way through something we call respite vouchers or respite stipends, where families are given dollars to purchase the respite either from a community-based program or from anyone they choose from their networks. They can pay their family or friends or their church neighbors or friends to come in and provide respite. And during COVID, I mean, that's been going on for quite a while, the self-directed type of respite services. But during COVID, that got even more flexible. States were able to increase the amount of the voucher. They were able to increase the length of time over which the voucher could be used. But most importantly, they increased the flexibility in who families could hire to provide that respite. For the first time, they could hire another family member who lives in the same household to provide that respite. That's never been permitted before. But because families were so desperate for that support and so fearful of bringing someone they didn't know into their home during COVID, that was really welcome. And that wasn't just in our lifespan programs. The Medicaid waiver programs were doing very similar things around flexibility and who could provide respite, making it even more person and family centered than it was before. And from what I'm hearing, while some of those Medicaid provisions were very fearful, maybe cut off at a certain point, our lifespan grantees who have more flexibility, they all told us last week at our grantee meeting that they plan to not change those improvements that they made to their voucher programs over COVID. In fact, they all promised to continue some of the services that they developed, like the mental health support, like the care packages, like the weekly check-ins. They're gonna continue to do those things even as we open up to more community-based options. So that's very exciting to see that people have recognized that the changes they made were very welcomed by families for the most part, and those things that were most accepted, they're gonna continue to provide. So I think that's very exciting. And we also, as you know, we did have some examples of community-based programs that reopened fairly early in COVID in the spring of last year, April or May. And they provided, I followed your lead on this, we provided some case studies of community-based programs that were able to open safely during the pandemic. And we brought those folks in and formed an expert work group to help us develop those guidelines for opening, for providing and using respite safely during the pandemic. And I think a lot of the things we learned in developing that guidebook will also continue to use, because there's nothing wrong with enhanced safety protocols and decision guides in using and providing respite services. And we're updating those right now to reflect the most recent guidance from our Centers for Disease Control and other state public health departments, and including all the information we need to know about vaccinations. And we'll be updating that this summer as well. I mean, we envision this pandemic isn't over by any stretch of the imagination either. So yeah. We have to be prepared, as fall and winter arrive and the new variants emerge, we're still going to have to be dealing with all of the issues about safety and concerns about the contracting the disease, especially in some of our states where the vaccination rates are incredibly low.
Yeah. I was going to ask just a related question to that, Jill, just, you know, how are things changing now in the States? Are services that had to be shut down or where numbers had to be, you know, drastically reduced, are they starting to recover a bit? Are they starting to open up again?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Oh. We're moving toward almost completely open services at this point, except for pockets of states where things are really, really bad right now. States like Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama. I mean, they're reaching levels reminiscent of the early days of COVID. So in those instances, I'm hopeful that things will be a little bit more restricted. but for the most part, things are really starting to return to normal. Though I think there's still fear among families, especially if you have a child with serious medical issues. And so children under 12 not being able to be vaccinated, especially in the child population, I think there's still tremendous concern about using out-of-home care or bringing individuals into the home to provide care.
It's that balancing risk, isn't it? You were just referring to those you know, tragic statistics about the number of people that are experiencing, you know, very serious mental health issues because they've been cut off from a lot of that support. And if the longer we leave people in that situation without access to those services, then there's that posing the greater risk, you know, to people.
Exactly. That's why we felt so compelled. If there is any way for states to continue to provide that in-person support, if we can help them do that safely and increase the confidence among families to use those, that they could use those services safely, that we were going to try to help them do that. So I'm really proud of the work that we did around our national guidelines for opening and staying open.
That was a great piece of work. And it's something, again, that we we've lifted and popped onto our website as well, because, you know, I think as this conversation has shown, that if there's, you know, despite the fact there's a big, you know, ocean between us, it's we're experiencing very similar challenges and difficulties, you know, in trying to be able to support people through this very difficult period. And one of the things that we're very keen to do is to try and support services to get to reinstate their provision just as quickly and safely as possible. And we know that services want to be in that position too. You know, it's
yes, they do.
Not that they are sort of holding back. They're just needing that sort of reassurance and confidence and the guidelines in order to, you know, feel confident that they can do that safely.
We owe a lot of the great work that ARCH was able to do in this area to, as you know, Dr. Kim Whitmore, who's now at Marquette University, who also has a public health, very strong public health background, really helped us develop those guidelines. So, and she's doing all of the updating now for the current guidance.
What did COVID mean for ARCH as an organization, Jill? And what impact do you think that's going to have on the organization in the future?
For us, we try to always be completely responsive to what our network tells us they need. And from day one of COVID, what they wanted to do was be able to speak with each other across states, across programs. And so the first thing we did was institute weekly Zoom calls with everyone across the states so they could share what was happening in their states. Share their great ideas for how they were responding, to talk about the challenges that they still faced in their individual states. You know, they were all facing different, even though there was guidance from the federal level, they were all also facing individual state guidance from their state departments of health. And so there were lots of issues that states were dealing with, and they were able to share those and talk about how they overcame them. How did they get PPE? How did they get designated as essential services? All of these issues that they never had to deal with before. being able to talk to folks in other states about the same kinds of services being provided, how were they doing that, was extremely helpful. And we tried to be always responsive to what our network was telling us they needed in terms of information and guidance. And we continue to do that. As far as our organization, to be perfectly honest, it didn't affect us tremendously because we've always worked out of our home offices anyway. You know, all of my consultants that I work with on a regular basis are in all different parts of the country. And we have always communicated via conference call or other virtual means. So on a day-to-day basis, our work wasn't terrifically impacted. And as states were getting, as the federal government was recognizing the needs of states, there was new funding coming down as well to deal with the COVID situation. And so in terms of funding, everybody was doing pretty well and continue to do pretty well. In fact, some states have not been able to absorb all the funding that's been coming from the federal government. So there's been some frustration around that. How do we take all this money? We can't spend it quickly enough because we don't have the infrastructure at the state level. We don't have the staffing to get the money out the door. But that's starting to equilibrate a little bit. And states, as I was saying, have used the funding very creatively to get new services and approaches going. I think it's refocused our training and technical assistance that we do more from written products to more of a learning collaborative type situation. We've got three or four learning collaboratives going now because the thing our folks want more than anything is to be able to talk with each other and learn from each other about their mistakes and their challenges and their best practices. So, you know, while we'll still continue to produce some fact sheets and guidebooks, I think our focus is really going to be on the virtual training opportunities that we've always used, but now have become even more popular. I think Zoom has done a tremendous amount to, you know, now we don't have to have a conference call where you can't see people, to now being able to see our colleagues and friends. And I think that has made a big difference too, even though everyone's zoomed out a little bit. When we hold something like our grantee meeting last week for two afternoons, we didn't have anybody drop out over 2 days, 4 hours. People stayed the entire time because they're so desperate and interested in learning from each other. There's still a lot of benefits to that approach. So, you know, we're really looking forward to an in-person meeting next year. We hope we can hold our National Lifespan Respite Conference in person next year, but I think the virtual events so far have been wildly successful.
So some real positive takeaways, yeah, in spite of everything else. Exactly. That's really good to hear.
Okay, Jill, I think that brings us to the end of our conversation. Just to thank you very much for giving us the benefit of your time. It's been lovely to speak to you, and I'm sure people will be really interested just to hear about the work and some of the you know, policy developments in the States. I mean, if people want to find out a bit more about your work, where could they go?
Oh, please visit our website. It's Arch Respite, ARCHRESPITE.org.
It's a fantastic website, and it's one that we refer to frequently, you know, when we're looking for help or some good ideas. So I would certainly encourage people to give it a look.
Well, thank you. It's really been a wonderful opportunity, and I love speaking with both of you. And again, you all, everything you do at Shared Care Scotland has been inspiring me in our work over here constantly. So our next work, I hope, will be around your inspirational breaks training. Excellent. I'm hoping we'll get to do more together on that effort as well.
All right. Thanks again, Jill. Thanks very much indeed.
Thank you very much. Great to talk with you.